What keeps me awake?
I'm Luca Belgiorno-Nettis, and this is What Keeps Me Awake, General Elections. Often, too often, I lie awake thinking that politics is the big problem, and that the greatest underused asset in politics is the common sense of everyday people. The conventional wisdom suggests that the common sense finds its voice through the election process. But there's a growing band of people like me who think that elections are actually part of the problem. And if we don't change them out, we'll have even more of the same: puerile bickering, fractured parliaments, and divisive societies. And that's keeping me awake.
Luca Belgiorno-Nettis, investor, architect, patron of the arts, and founder of the New Democracy Foundation.
The Australian people have voted. It will be a few more days before we get a clearer picture. There is no doubt that there is a level of disillusionment with politics, with government, and with the major parties, our own included.
When Mr. Turnbull said at the last election that there is a level of disillusionment with politics, he became the first Prime Minister to admit that there's a problem. But Australia is not alone. The US presidential race and the Brexit referendum were both initially regarded as thoroughly democratic, but are now seen as deeply divisive. Modern democracy may champion free and fair elections and referenda, but they've devolved into banal popularity contests and sloganeering circuses. We've completely lost sight of the genius of the original democracy that relied on political representation not through elections, but by lot, as in the jury. The conventional wisdom is also that everyday people, co-opted into parliament like a jury, have limited capacity to contribute to public policy. However, over the last 10 years, and especially the last five, citizen juries in Australia and around the world show that we can do democracy better, more productively, and more collaboratively. To help us deliberate on this, I've sought out Belgian political philosopher David Van Reybroek. He's just published a book called Provocatively, Against Elections, and subtitled The Case for Democracy.
The thing is, we blame many things in our democracies. We blame parties, we blame politicians and parliaments, and sometimes we even blame the people. But I think the real problem is with none of these. The problem is with procedures rather than anything else. Now, procedures in a modern democracy essentially boils down to elections. And it's a little bit strange because we've been trying to do democracy for the past, let's say, 3,000 years. We've only been doing it through elections for the past 200 years. And yet we seem to believe that if you want to have a democracy, you are bound to organize elections. So I think we should stop thinking that elections are synonymous with democracies. They can help democracies, of course, but they can also bring dictators to power, like we've seen in the 1930s in Germany. And I think it's important to remember, it is not because you have elections that you automatically get democracies.
David, the question about elections is that there's some sort of sense that in that rigorous contest, the best and the brightest come out. So how do you answer that critique?
Well, if you translate the word the best leader, the best leadership into Greek, you get aristocracy, which is government by those who are consider themselves to be the best.
The rule of the elite.
Democracy, however, is a different business. Now, if you look at the way it was organized in ancient Athens, then it's important to remember that there were about 7,000 public functions in Athens. Of these 7,000, only 100 were elected. It was mostly the generals of the army and the treasurers of the national budget. All the rest were drafted by lot. Now, that sounds a little bit strange to our ears nowadays, and yet it is quite important. It is quite important to remember that in the cradle of democracy, elections played only a very limited role, and the very idea that people should govern themselves was basically made possible through the instrument of lottery. When I was a kid at my school, I grew up in Belgium on the Flemish countryside. In my school, I was always told that the French and the American revolutions did away with aristocracy, policy in order to make democracy possible, and this thanks to elections. Now, if you look at it in detail, it might have been my school teacher, but if you look at it in more detail, what the revolutionaries did away with was not aristocracy as such, but hereditary aristocracy. And they replaced it by a new form of aristocracy. Thomas Jefferson even called it a natural aristocracy. Indeed. And that was one that was based on elections. So elections were there not to make democracy possible, but to stop democracy. The revolutionaries were convinced Republicans, but they were very afraid of the very word and the very practice of democracy. So their idea was basically like, let's avoid by all means the rule of the mob. That's what they feared.
And indeed, John Adams, the second American president, said, remember, democracy never lasts long. It soon wastes, exhausts, and murders itself. There never was a democracy yet that did not commit suicide. And then James Madison, the father of the American Constitution, he was convinced that democracies had always been, in his words, spectacles of turbulence and contention, which generally speaking, again his words, have been as short in their lives as they have been violent in their deaths. So there was a sense that the great unwashed had no capacity to in fact, should be kept at bay from the important role of government.
Yeah, if you hear these statements, you're quite surprised that these folks are so venerated in the United States. I mean, they were children of their time as well, and some of their visions were heavily tainted by the context within they had to work. What you basically see, after revolution, the people make the revolution, the people who are at the Bastille, and the number one or the number ones are chased away, and it's the numbers two of society who take the place of number one. This is what you had in Egypt a couple of years ago, and this is what you had in France. And America.
Now, we have been working, as I said, at opposite ends of the globe on trying to think about how this problem of politics itself can be remedied. And along with others, and we're not the only ones here, we're a group of deliberative Democrats, we've found that these particular processes of lottery selection, of introducing representative groups selected randomly, so like a jury, and giving these people the opportunity to deliberate time, information, space, they make sensible decisions. You had this experience at the time that the Belgium Parliament had vacated their space for, close to a year and a half. Can you tell us what happened? It was 2011, wasn't it?
2010-2011, Belgium still holds the record for the country of the longest period without the government, so 541 days. And many people thought like, well, this is normal because Belgium is such a complex country. And that was my reading of the facts in the beginning as well. And then I started to realize this is no longer a Belgian problem. This is a democratic problem because our politicians couldn't form a government because the issues were too difficult, but because they were afraid of losing the next election if they compromised too much. And that made me realize, hang on, for the first time in history, we see that the weight of the next election is becoming more important than the weight of the previous election. Now, elections were introduced to make forms of government possible, not to be an obstacle to them. So I realized, hang on, this is a very old procedure, these elections. It's 200 years old. It's quite an arcane and primitive procedure. And it's no longer working at a time that people can follow the news every single second of the day. People can comment upon it. Information has gone so much more faster in the 21st century. And we still go back to a procedure from the late 18th century. So our argument was if politicians cannot reach an agreement, let's invite citizens in and let's see what they would consider an acceptable form. And that was a little bit the whole idea behind it. And what we basically did is that we drafted by lot 1,000 Belgian citizens. And there was this one-day citizen summit in Brussels where people came together from all walks of life, all ages and genders and provinces and languages. We got three official languages. We're a tiny country, but we have three official languages. And people came together for a full day to talk on a number of topics they thought were essential to the future of the country. And all these topics were introduced by academic experts. And after these introductions, people were given the chance to talk to each other on round tables. There were seated 10 people around the table with a moderator on every table. What strikes me most when I'm there now as an observer or whatever, it's the sound. The sound of deliberative democracy is a sound which I don't hear very often anymore in regular representative democracy. It's the sound of people talking.
Talking and not bickering.
Exactly. I mean, our democracies, our contemporary democracies, they have become very silent. We vote in silence, and then afterwards we go back on Facebook to shout in silence for the next 4 years, and then again we vote in silence. Democracy is based on dialogue. That is, means on some sort of civilized conversation and exchange of arguments. And I found it is very moving that it is possible for a crosscut, a representative crosscut of society, who people who do not know each other, they can sit down together for 1 day, 2 days, several days, several weekends, talk issues through in a way which they never ever do. They talk about each other, they don't talk to each other. And I think that is quite remarkable. I know in the beginning it sounds a little bit strange going back to lottery. I mean, I know it sounds a bit freakish, but we're using lottery already every day, and we do it in the worst possible way. We call it opinion polls. With the opinion polls, we ask a random sample of people what they think when they don't think. And what you and I try to do on different sides of the globe is trying to see what people think after they had a chance to think, and try to hear what they say then, after information, after having been given time and space. And I think that is a very interesting improvement on the democratic model we have right now. We're basically moving from the right to vote to the right to speak.
So what we're saying, you and I and other deliberative Democrats are saying, we're not wanting to remove or do away with competency where competency is required. What we're looking to do is enable public trust to be developed more fully in political decisions where that trust is starting to erode.
Well, I think competence is obviously very important in any democracy today. If I look at many European parliaments, you see how it's full of competent people at best, but many of those can't even use their competence because they are bound by party discipline or by the need to win the next election as well. So what is the value of a parliament full of highly educated people who cannot always exercise their intelligence and their competence? It's true, if you work with people drafted by lot, you are going to have less competence in your assembly. I mean, that is true. The good thing is the lack of competence can be taken care of just by giving people the adequate information and by giving them time and space to engage with the materials. So it's a weakness that can be remedied quite easily. What you and I are claiming is that we shouldn't replace the existing model that is based on elections. We only should enrich it. We should, but by something new, but by a more powerful and an interesting instrument, which is random selection.
David, thanks so much for your time.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you. Thank you, Luca.
David Van Reybroek, political philosopher and author of Against Elections: The Case for Democracy.
What keeps me awake?
I'm Luca Belgiorno-Nettis, guest presenter for RN's What Keeps Me Awake. And what's keeping me awake, too often, is the problem with politics. I think the greatest underused asset in politics is the common sense of everyday people. To talk this through, I've asked two well-known politicians to join me. The former Premier of New South Wales, Nick Greiner, and Jay Weatherill, Premier of South Australia, who has been running Australia's largest jury to advise on the question, under what circumstances, if any, could South Australia pursue the opportunity to store and dispose of nuclear waste from other countries? Premier, why did you go down this path? And isn't it the job of parliaments and politicians to decide such things?
I suppose my motivation is just to make better decisions. And I think that the community expects much more of their democracy than just being checked in with every 4 years. They want to be actively engaged. So that's the good news, that people want to play a bigger role in their democracy. They want to be involved in the decisions that affect their lives. And the better news is that it improves the quality of decisions and ultimately improves the durability of those decisions. So for me, it's actually about, I got in politics to change things. I'm a reformist. I come from a progressive left perspective. I want to make the world a better place, and I'm frustrated at the pace of change, and often complex decisions prove to be really too much for governments, and we'll see, you know, lots of stalemates over big complex questions. And so for me, it's about how we use some of these tools, like you've spoken about, deliberative democracy tools like citizens' juries and other things, to actually take what I describe as mass opinion and translate it into public judgment through these processes. And that's really what we've been experimenting with in South Australia, and I think we've been having some success.
Nick, what do you think juries offer that the current political system can't?
It seems to me that over the, say, 30 years since I became Premier, it's actually got much harder for all the reasons that we know and we perhaps don't need to go through, but the nature of society, the nature of the media and technology, the media cycle, all of those things have made it even more difficult for governments to make reform decisions that might be called contested or difficult. So I thought that what you've been trying to do, I guess for almost a decade, was a way of helping the elected officials, the elected governments, to get more support from the mass market than the conventional simplistic public opinion polling, or indeed politicians going by the seat of their pants or the seat of their advisors' pants. So I frankly thought it was a significant helping hand, or potential significant helping hand, to make reform more achievable. And the other good thing about it isn't a left-right sort of idea. It's an assistance to reformers, regardless of where they might come from across the political spectrum.
I think there are ways where political representation could be affected outside of a party system, and I'm keen to explore that.
From my perspective, I still see an important role for politicians and for parties. To me, I agree with Nick. I mean, this doesn't necessarily have to be something that's owned by the political left or the political right. In some ways, these are tools that can assist in a better democracy. So, you know, the idea that we're just stuck with an election and that's somehow meant to render some mandate which carries you through the whole 4 years with things that may never have even been contemplated by the electorate during that period, it just seems a little unrealistic to think that somehow you have this community permission to do things.
Before you go on, Premier, if I could ask Nick for his views on this.
Well, I think you've got to expect Jay and me to think that the body politic and the politicians are not as past their use-by date as you or other observers might think, Luca. I hate to sound like a unity ticket with Jay, but at the end of the day, it's about the results. It's about the outcome. And therefore, I think the way of testing the way the existing traditional system works, or the way that new democracy type ideas can assist, at the end of the day, the only criterion is what happens. It's the results that count. So I don't think you're likely to quickly move to a system that disenfranchises the traditional political process. But I think the purpose is, my purpose might be a little bit different, I think, Luca, from yours, is to make the system we've got work. And I think the charge against it, and it's not just in Australia, it's pretty much around the world, is that the existing system doesn't work. And it doesn't work when set against the criteria of allowing whichever governments to make decisions that are difficult, that are contested, but which might, on a judgmental basis, to use Jay's word, actually be clearly in the public interest. So it enables things to happen. So that's, you know, my starting point isn't really about process and about politics. It's about results and outcomes and working back from that. And that's where I find the attraction in some of the new democracy ideas, rather than in the supposition that one can actually overthrow the system in total, although maybe you can.
Can I just give some observations about citizens' jury? Because they've been very powerful. I remember the first one I went to, a gentleman came up to me and I asked him, why is he doing this? And he said, I'm here because I've got a young son and I wanted to be able to say to him that politics can work. It's just a really simple but, you know, profoundly idealistic view about what he wanted for the future for his son and his society. The other thing that struck me in this really big citizens' jury that we're running at the moment, this one about nuclear fuel cycle, now that's a pretty hot issue. You know, we got 350 people. You'd imagine any group of 350, you'd have 20 people at least on both sides who'd have passionate views on one way or the other. And you'd expect them to be quite militant about that. The thing that has emerged through these deliberative processes, the first thing that happens is that greater respect grows between people holding opposite points of view. They begin when they hear people in a calm, considered environment expressing their genuinely held views, they begin to gain a respect for them. And it civilizes the discourse. It's the first thing that you see.
Premier, this is the heart of the issue for me. And this is part of the problem with the political system at the moment is because we set up these silos of party politics, of electioneering, of one party in one group trying to distinguish themselves from the other, they automatically frustrate the capacity to collaborate and deliberate.
Yeah, but Luca, if you go back 20 and 30 years in Australia to the Hawke Keating period and Howard was the opposition leader, and if you go to various European countries, grand coalitions are possible. It's not endemic to the existing institutions that you have to have the sort of 100% almost adversarial approach on big issues that we've got. So, I mean, it is possible to push the system towards and to push the players towards more of a consensus building, whether it's formal grand coalitions. I mean, they tend to happen in wartime or because of the arithmetic of election results. But I think you can achieve getting people out of their silos and having a sense of the national or the overriding interest. It doesn't automatically require you to have new institutions. It requires you, frankly, to have some change in the minds of the political leaderships.
I'm sorry, Nick, I disagree. I really think this is systemic. You see it at every election. Every party is wanting to distinguish themselves, have to stick to their particular mantra, and they cannot resolve from that. Otherwise, they seem to be weakened.
Luca, can I ride to the rescue of the former Premier? I want to say two things. One is you'd be surprised, and this is under the current system, even as bad as it looks from the outside, you'd be surprised at the amount of agreement there is about a lot of things. And of course, the media doesn't have an interest in telling you about that. You know, suddenly today, Leader of the Opposition and the Premier agreed to pass a number of bills through the parliament that are worthy and are going to improve life in South Australia. That doesn't get reported. What they want to cover is the conflict. So 80% of probably even more, 90% of legislation is passed by agreement or is amended and was acquiesced in as an improvement to the government's bill. So, but it is true, and Nick's point, I think, is that some of the big issues have become stuck. But the other thing I want to say is that I don't think it's just about these deliberative processes. I think it's also about practice, how politicians see their role and how, and there's something that Bob Hawke used to always say, I trust in the intelligence of the Australian electorate, or words to that effect. And the truth is the way in which they conducted the discourse about the opening up of the Australian economy in the mid-80s treated the electorate as though they're intelligent. Remember, we had Paul Keating telling us about J-curves and all manner of things.
Banana republics.
Well, that's right, but nobody entirely understood what he was talking about, but we at least liked the fact that he was paying us the respect of talking to us about it. And I think the general level of intelligence of the public discourse improved. Now, true it was that you needed an opposition leader like John Howard who was also prepared to cooperate in that discussion, but you know, I think the starting point has to come from a government. The government has to take people into their trust, be prepared to give them information, real information, often not sugar-coated. And I think that can be an important starting point.
Premier, what I am arguing for is that I think the basic level of trust is so low because it's also seen to be somewhat self-serving. Mm. No longer is the politician simply interested in the good of the country. In the sense, that's not the perception anymore. The perception is they are there to get their backsides onto the velvet.
But I don't agree with that. And I
well, the statistics are there, Premier.
Well, but what
politicians are regarded like a used car salesman.
What if the question is this, though? What if the problem isn't that people don't trust politicians? What if the problem is that politicians don't trust people? Mm-hmm. And I think that takes you back to having the courage to actually tell people they don't want to hear and be prepared to expose yourself to discussions which, you know, this deliberative debate that, now it can get bumpy, but I think ultimately, I think that's the way of actually getting reform.
Absolutely. And then I come back to the question again, is I think there are institutional reforms that could assist that.
Maybe.
I could live with a maybe. Nick.
I'll give you a maybe. I just think you got a bit of you got a mountain to climb to start with, and I think the institutional reform is a sort of second mountain, if I could put it that way.
Well, indeed, you're right. Well, I got my eye on the hill. Thank you, gentlemen, for joining us. I hope after this conversation, you'll still be allies.
Indeed we will. I certainly will.
My thanks to Jay Weatherill, Premier of South Australia, and to Nick Greiner, former New South Wales Premier, and David Van Reybrouck, political philosopher and author of Against Elections, The Case for Democracy. I'm Luca Belgiorno-Nettis, this week's guest presenter for RN's What Keeps Me Awake. And my parting thoughts? Well, I'll leave you with that rap song that I wrote and arranged some 10 years ago. It's called The Party's Over. And I still feel the same way about politics, only more so now.
Our nation, our state. Don't need a forum filled with stupid, mindless debate. Are the leader and opposition? No difference in proposition. A just win position. You lose position.
This is a rap lament for our government. The instrument of our predicament. Let's take this chase to this place, face to face with the political race. This is hip hop on our big top. It's a flip-flop, when's it gonna stop? Party's over, the party's over.
The party's over, where do we go now? The game is up, locked in a chamber. The party's over, where do we go now? The game is up, locked in a chamber.
What keeps me awake? For more, head to the RN front page.